Our last speaker is going to be Rabbi Dr. Steinberg, and based on what we've heard today, the last session will basically fill in the gaps and will be a good prelude to a discussion that we will have. So the idea now is to sort of wrap this this discussion up in some meaningful fashion, and then we will leave about 30 minutes for discussion, and we will do so in a few moments. But before I do so, and this is not so much of a PR, but just an understanding of the individual that is going to be speaking on this, Rabbi Dr. Steinberg, as you all know, is one of the experts and has been involved in this discussion. He has been on the list that we've seen today on the sides that who are the poskim that have been dealing with this issue. But I want to point out that he has just published a new book specifically on this issue, and it is available. You can speak to Yuna. You can speak to Rabbi Dr. Steinberg, but in this book here that has just been published, it goes through some of the discussion that obviously we can't do in a short order of a weekend. But just to put the point as a matter of introduction, the last speaker now wrote the book on this subject. So it gives me great pleasure to call on Rabbi Dr. Steinberg.
As you know, people who speak about something before they start talking, they want to say a few words. So I want to say a few personal words before I enter into the issue. One is to be fair with the discussion. My personal opinion is that what is called brain death, and I think it's from my point of view a misnomer, is accepted halakhically. So that is my opinion on the side of the controversy, and obviously I am biased when I talk about this issue towards this aspect. Second is that I feel myself very privileged to be in a position of someone who dealt directly with almost all the gedolim that have said something about the issue. I don't think that there are many who were able to do that, and I feel myself very privileged, and therefore a lot of the debates which are polemics and rechilus and he said so and he said that and no one really was there when things were happening, I think become very disturbing and irrelevant if someone really was on the site directly. So just to mention a few, I spent many hours, and I was very privileged to do so, with Shon Zalman and Auerbach on this matter, as well as other issues, but on this matter particularly. I was very close with the Tzitz Eliezer that was mentioned. He was the neighbor of Shaaret Tzedek, and I worked at Shaaret Tzedek, and every question we used to discuss with him, and certainly this issue, I spent a lot of time with him. I discussed the matter with many of the Gedolim that are not alive, including the Minchas Yitzchak, Arav Shaul Israeli that was mentioned, Arav Mordechai Eliyahu, Arav Avram Shapira, really all the people that you'll find in the literature their opinions, and many of the people that are alive with us, Baruch Hashem, like Arav Eliashiv, Arav Vozner, Rav Zal Nechemia Goldberg, Rav Moshe Sternbuch, all these individuals I discussed with them, I heard their opinion, and they know my humble opinion, and really I think it's embarrassing to be on a list of gedolim that say one thing or the other. I mean, I can say what I want, I'm not a gadol, I'm not a poisek, I can't be on such a list. I'm surprised, I just found out that I'm on this list, I didn't know. And I'm sure my dear friend Avram, who will disagree on this particular issue, but we cooperate on many issues, he will probably be the same embarrassed if he'll know that he's on the other list as being one of the poskim dealing with such enormous issues. But we are allowed to have our opinion. So that is just a preface to what I want to say. Now, I put in the slides, and you have it in front of you, all the sources and the explanations from the point of view of those who accept what is called brain death. I'm not going to discuss it again. We did it, I think, last year, and you can find it there, and you can find it in the new book that came out. This is to present one opinion. An opinion, and not the opinion. It is not to say that whoever disagrees with this opinion is worthless, is useless, is an idiot, whatever terminology the American people who fight this issue are using for each other. I find it very disturbing the way the issue of brain death acceptance or disacceptance has been in this country. And I am happy to say that in Israel it didn't turn to this way. There are the same disagreements, the same Gedolim who disagree on the issue, but one accepts the option that it can be different and you can ask another one, including the Gedolim. And I can relate to you, for instance, a friend of mine, a physician in one of the big hospitals in Israel, who belongs to the Dati Leumi group, and unfortunately this issue became the Dati Leumi Haredi division, although it has nothing to do neither with Tzionut nor with Tfilah v'Shlom HaMdina, and I don't know why it came out to be that way. But his poisek is Rav Eliashiv. He belongs to the Dati Leumi group, but he asked Rav Eliashiv Shailas, and he was appointed as one of the people who defines brain death as a physician. And he went to Rav Eliashiv to ask, can he be on this committee? And Rav Eliashiv said, sure, you listen to Rav Avram Shapira. Rav Avram Shapira said, it's okay, so you can be on this committee. If you ask me if it's okay, my personal view is that, but you're allowed to go according to your poisek that in general you ask him. So even Rav Eliashiv gave this permission. Recently, I spoke with Rav Efrati, who is one of the closest people to Rav Eliashiv, and I'll explain to you the latest that happens with this issue in Israel, and that's really my mandate, not to go over the opinions for or against. And Rav Efrati was very happy to hear what those who accept brain death are going to do now, although he belongs to the group that doesn't accept it. So the fact that there are differences of opinions is not a surprise, as Rabbi Glad said, and as we all know, show me one page in Shas where there's no machloikis. In fact, there is. There's one chapter in Shas without machloikis, and that is Ezur Mekoyman Shazvochim. It's one chapter without machloikis, and that's why we say it every morning, to know that it can be without a machloikis. But that's an exception to the rule. Every issue has a machloikis. In fact, some of the Rabbonim say that if an issue is not disputable, people don't follow it at all. They don't know about it. They only know those issues that are disputable, and then they go one way or the other. So I think that it is okay to be in disagreement. One has to choose the poisek. I chose my poisek. So I am the side that accepts what is called brain death. Now, when I say what is called brain death, in my understanding, the definition of the moment of death, as I, and I am not the important part, as the poskim that I understand their position, is not an organ, but a function. It has nothing to do neither with the brain, nor with the heart, nor with the nostril, nor with the navel, nor with the lung. This is not what defines death. If the sugya in Yuma says that you have to check his nostril, it doesn't mean that if he's missing the nostril, he's dead. That everyone understands. So it's not the nostril as such that defines the moment of death. It is the function that defines moment of death. And to me, it's very clear that the function defining the moment of death is respiration. Whether you call it the nostril or the heart, according to the knowledge, to the scientific knowledge in those days, that the heart pumped air, and that was equivalent to the lung, and therefore when it says ad libo, it means breathing, the same way as ad chotmo, that is very clear from what we know historically, and certainly, according to most Gelsers, that doesn't quote ad libo at all, that is not existent at all, but the opposite to ad chotmo is the navel, then certainly it's the diaphragmatic breathing. The navel cannot make one assume that he is alive or dead. So these are all signs of breathing. So the breathing is the function, and in fact, the Gemara in Yuma concludes with a posuk, Vayimach kol asher nishmat ruach hayim ba'apo. So that the neshama, which is the same etymological source, is the factor that makes one alive or dead. That is a definition of the moment of death. And based on this definition, I'm going to proceed with what I want to tell you about what's happening in Israel. Now, as you may know, there are a lot of definitions of the moment of death, and one can assume that we can get very quickly to cerebral death, not even whole brain death, which would be a PV, a persistent vegetative state, can be defined as dead, and then you'll have a lot of organs. Obviously, that will not be acceptable by any halakhic criteria. There's a whole host of definitions, and again, I'm not going to go into it, but what is important to understand is that no matter what type of definition you choose, whether it's circulatory because you use the heart as what we understand today as a circulatory center, or whether it is breathing, or whether it is blood flow, or whether it is an aid, no matter what definition you choose, it has to be irreversible. If it is reversible, then the person was never dead. That is to take away from the concept of clinical death. When physicians say he was clinically dead, they actually say we made a mistake and we thought he was dead. But they cover the mistake and they say it was a clinical death. There's no clinical death. Either he's dead or he's alive. There are no in-betweens. There's no half pregnancy. So it has to be irreversibly dead. And that has to be done in a most reliable fashion. And this is the point that the Israeli controversy is now getting into a solution. The controversy about what defines the moment of death is not new. It was in the old days, in the 18th century, a very interesting a situation where the uncertainty of diagnosis of death was very great. Physicians did not have stethoscopes, did not have EKGs. All they had was their eyesight to see if a feather is moving when they put it next to the nostril, and their ear to hear if there is heart functioning. And now imagine an elderly physician whose eyesight is already not as it used to be, and his hearing is also not so as it used to be, and he puts a feather, there is some movement, but he didn't see, so he checks no breathing. He puts his ear on the heart, there is a feeble murmur, but he doesn't hear, so he checks no heart function. They bury the patient, and the patient wants to get up. Now, they build such types of coffins where the surface, this is the surface of the earth. There was an opening up around the surface with a bell attached to the hands of the dead. And when he got up, because by mistake he was there, so he was saved by the bell. So the expression "saved by the bell" apparently comes from here, which means that there were people buried alive. And the question was, from a halachic point of view, what do you do? Shouldn't you bury someone until you are sure 100% that he is dead, which means in those days waiting 3 days after the physician said that he's not breathing and no heart functioning, but then you're over on Baltalin. You're not allowed to keep a dead person overnight without burying him. So that machloikes was a major machloikes between Moses Mendelssohn and the Yavetz, and that was a very famous machloikes, and a generation later the Chatam Sofer went into it in more details, and the tshuva of the Chatam Sofer really, based on this historic event, serves today as a basis of the dispute. How do you understand his tshuva, which is a very interesting one, and again, I'm not going to go into the substance of the matter. In the 20th century and today, there are other issues that came up with the ability to separate in time between breathing and heart functioning. In the old days, before the respirators were available, so whoever stopped breathing, within 5 minutes, his heart will stop. Whose heart stopped, within a minute, he will stop breathing and his brain will die. So there was no real question what really constitutes a moment of death. So they said, let's check both of them. Today, a person on a respirator who is not breathing, and if he's brain dead, he will never breathe again, his heart can function for days and weeks and sometimes even months. So now the question is, by what criteria is it dead? And therefore, this is the dispute that we are facing today. In order to understand the tshuvas of Rav Moshe, one has to look into the history of the tshuva, and I think by now it's quite clear that Moshe's position is that respiratory death is dead, and I think it's very hard to understand him differently, although you can always understand differently if you want so. But taking the background, and I don't want to go into it, it seems like his position was very clear. Now, let me go into the medical aspect very shortly in order to understand what has happened over the last few years in Israel. The medical criteria to establish brain death include prerequisite conditions, which is make sure that you know the etiology, because if you don't know the etiology, it might be reversible. Be sure that there are no reversible underlying conditions such as hypothermia. A person with 30 degrees temperature looks like brain dead. And when you do the testing on him, he will test brain dead. But if you warm up, he will walk out and ask for an ice cream. So that has to be verified that the person doesn't have conditions that mimic the situation of brain dead. Once you verify these prerequisites, there is a clinical set of testings to say whether he is brain dead, and there are confirmatory tests, which are objective tests, which are done by machines. These are done by human beings, by the physicians, so that they check for the depths of the coma. There is a scale which is called the Glasgow Coma Scale, and it has to be 3. And if it's more than 3, then obviously he's not brain dead. There should be an absence of all brainstem reflexes, including the pupillary response to light, corneal response, gag reflex, cold caloric test. There's a whole host of tests that one does in order to verify that the brainstem reflexes cease from functioning. And the most important one is to do an apnea test, which is verifying that he is not breathing without the respirator. Now you may say, if we'll take him off the respirator, we'll fulfill the prophecy. He will die because you took him off the respirator. But in fact, we know how to do it today by taking him out of the respirator for a few minutes and checking whether he is breathing without causing any damage to any of his organs and without hastening death if he's still alive. So once we verify the clinical aspects of the situation of brain death, and as you can see, this is a must in the clinical diagnosis of brain death, that he's not breathing, then you can do confirmatory tests, either check blood flow in various ways or check electric activity of the brainstem in various ways. And if you find that there's no blood flow and or no electric activity in the brain, then you confirm that clinically the person is brain dead. The big dispute in Israel was about this part. The physicians claim, and maybe they are right, that the clinical tests are enough. You can do them and you can be sure that the person is brain dead if all these tests, the clinical tests, confirm the situation. The chief rabbinate that accepted the concept of brain death, actually respiratory brain death, said, okay, that is clinically right, but A, you may have had a mistake, you're just a human being, maybe you took him off the respirator and you talked to someone for a minute and you didn't see that he's really breathing a little bit, and B, that is a reliability issue, there is a historic disbelief between the rabbinic establishment and the medical establishment, and the rabbis were afraid that physicians will shorten the way because it's already late, we need the organ, so if it wasn't done 100%, if it's not now, it will be a little later, who cares, and they will diagnose him as brain dead. And in order to avoid that, there was a request that an objective test that can be read, that can be seen on paper, that indeed proves that the person died and there was no mistake and no reliability issue. That was a major dispute throughout maybe 20 years. Now, the clinical test, as I said, you look for Glasgow Coma Scale. I won't go into it. Pupillary response to light, everyone knows it. There's the Dow's eye test, and there is the most important test, the ocular vestibular or cold caloric test, where one injects cold water into the ear, and the reflex is so strong that if the brainstem is alive, the eyes will move towards the ear that is irrigated with the cold water. And if the eyes don't move at all, that is a very strong sign that the brainstem doesn't function. And the apnea test is obviously looking at the person breathing, whether he is breathing or not, without the respirator, under extreme conditions of increasing PCO2 to the maximum stimulatory effect, and that is a very effective test. The confirmatory test can be of various testing, can be transcranial Doppler. Again, I'm not going to describe everything. It can be a carotid angiogram, it can be a radionuclide angiogram, which is a very important test because it shows not only blood flow in the brain, but uptake of the cells of the brain of the blood, which, as you can see on my left-hand side, an empty brain where there is no flow into the brain tissue. So, again, without repeating all the sources and interpreting them one way or the other, these are the famous sources that have been discussed by most of the poskim. There are a lot of differences in the manuscripts, and again, I'm not going to go into it. Then we move to the poskim. The Rambam clearly speaks only about respiration and nothing about the heart or whatever the heart represents. The same holds true for the Shulchan Aruch. And the same holds true for later poskim like the Chochmat Adam, who talks about putting a feather, and if you see that the feather is not moving, you know that the person is dead, and you don't look for any other signs. The major two achroinim, the Chacham Tzvi and the Chatam Sofer, again, I'm not going to go into the details, but I think it's very clear from the Chacham Tzvi that his understanding of the heart was a respiratory organ. And he writes it very clearly that מדברי כולם נלמד שהנשימה היא צורך הלב, ואם אין לב אין נשימה. The neshima is part of the heart. He doesn't talk about circulation, he doesn't talk about blood, he didn't know that blood comes from the heart. This was unavailable at that time even to the scientists, and therefore the heart is really an organ of breathing. And he goes on and on to show that this is what it shows. The Chassam Sofer is a different story, and again, I don't have the time to go into it. Now, our current poskim have a dispute between three options. One is a cardiopulmonary death, which is not only the cessation of respiration, but also the cessation of the heart. Shlomo Zalman Auerbach had a unique, single opinion. I don't think anyone agrees with him on his definition, and his definition was really brain death, the brain as such, each and every individual cell, including all parts of the brain, have to be dead, and it's very difficult to understand, according to that, many of the other sources. He has some explanations, and again, I don't have the time to go into it. And the position that we talk about respiratory death, which can be confirmed either by brain death or by cardiac death, which a whole group of other poskim agree to that. Now, and here comes I don't know if I have time to what I want to say. Here comes what happened in Israel. Even if you accept that brain death or respiratory death is acceptable, there are two issues that have to be solved. One is the reliability from a scientific point of view of the diagnosis, to be sure that indeed the person is irreversibly not breathing. And the second one was the reliability of physicians because of some distrust, so that even if scientifically you know how to do it, did the physicians do it in the right way? So in order to solve this matter, the chief rabbis 20 years ago, Rav Shapira and Rav Eliyahu, in a response to the Ministry of Health, wrote a Psak Halakha, which says that indeed brain death or respiratory death is the halakhic definition of death. However, they required additional conditions which the medical establishment at that time did not want to accept. Until 3 years ago, when the ministry, when until March 24, 2008, the Israeli Knesset enacted a law which accepted the principle of brain death as being the moment of death from a legal point of view, however requiring all the adjustments that the chief rabbinate wanted, despite the fact that the medical establishment opposed it. And that is now the law of the land. The law of the land says that you have to verify all the prerequisites, all the clinical criteria, and confirmatory tests in order to say that the person is legally brain dead according to the law in Israel. So that from a legal point of view, medically confirmed whole brain death according to this law is the legal moment of death. However, I discussed the law before it was enacted with Rav Eliashiv, and he was very worried from the consequences of the law, because according to his position, brain death is not acceptable halakhically. And then, with the agreement of the Knesset, we added a paragraph that said that families who disagree in principle with brain death can have their next of kin on a respirator until the heart stops. So that those who disagree with brain death can legally have their next of kin on a respirator until the heart stops. Those who agree to brain death need to be verified that indeed brain death occurred without any mistake and without any short circuit by confirmatory test. And this way, both halachic groups were satisfied with the law in Israel. Now, Rabbi Dr. Weiss mentioned Rabbi Israeli's concern about the Tichat Pele Satan in the donor car. This is the Israeli donor car called Adi, on the name of someone who died on a waiting list for an organ donation, and he didn't make it, and he died, and his family established this donor card, and it's known in Israel as the donor card of Adi. And it says, "Betikva ki uchal azor lazulat ani mitzave bazeh v'torem lachar moti so and so," which means I order or I agree that I can donate my organs after I die. Saying after I die is Tichat Pele Satan according to Rav Israeli, and therefore we offer now a different donor card. Where is it? I don't have it here, but the new donor card talks in general terms that we feel that it is right to, first of all, that we accept brain death, otherwise I wouldn't sign a donor card, and we agree that in principle it is morally obligating or morally allowed to donate an organ, and I agree to this moral approach. So I'm not talking about my death, and I'm not talking about me directly giving an organ, so I think from Arab Israeli's position that would have been okay. And finally, In order to verify that a person is brain dead totally, according to some of the poskim, especially the chief rabbi's Rabbi Obadiah Yosef and Rav Amar, and again, I was privileged to speak with both of them on the matter, and both of them said that, according to their opinion, brain death is absolutely accepted from a halachic point of view, and in fact, they ordered Shas, which is their party in the Knesset, to vote for the law that accepts, in principle, brain death with all the qualifications. And they even wrote it handwritten, not typed, for no one to say that it was falsified, like the tshuva of Moshe, the last one. And that is handwritten, and you can see that Harav Amar wrote the tshuva, and Harav Ovadia Yosef co-signed that he agrees with everything. And you can see that I was privileged to be there and explain their position. And according to them, it is not enough to say that if the law says that you have to do ABC, we can rely that it was really done. You have to verify it case by case. And therefore, we have established a group of reliable physicians that will be called to a brain death diagnosis whenever it will happen, wherever in Israel, and they will go over and verify that everything was done according to what now the law says, but primarily what the chief rabbinate required. And after that, the permission for organ donation will be granted by those rabbis, and the list of the rabbis that agree to this, the current chief rabbinate, Rav Amar and Rav Metzger, reaffirmed the position of the previous chief rabbinate of Rav Shapira and Rav Eliyahu, and in their resolution, if it is done the way I just described, it is acceptable. So in summary, the position that holds that cardiac death is the only definition, all this is irrelevant, because as long as the heart is functioning, it doesn't matter if you did more tests or less tests, the heart is still functioning, the person is still alive. According to the position that respiratory death proved to be irreversible by brainstem death is acceptable in principle as the definition of the moment of death, one has to verify that indeed this is the situation. And in order to do it, it's not enough to do a clinical diagnosis, you have to do a confirmatory test to show that indeed that is what happened, and you have to have witnesses that will confirm that indeed everything was done according to the regulations, and then it becomes a mitzvah. I agree that it's not a mitzvah chiyuvi, it's not a positive mitzvah that you must do it, but certainly if you do it, you're doing the right thing by saving lives if you accept that position. Thank you.
If I could ask the speakers from this morning to have a seat at the pen. To take a seat. We'll have a panel discussion. We'll open the floor for questions. We have 30 minutes for questions. Those that want to stay longer, please, if you. But again, there's going to be lunch served afterwards. I implore upon the questioners, brief questions to the point, and direct your question to the particular rabbi or rabbi that is on the panel, and we'll get started. Dr. Jessen.
Two very good questions. I'll repeat them for those that might not have heard. The first question is, how do you decide who your poser is? I think that's a very, very, very easy question to answer, and at the same time, it's a very difficult question to answer. And I'll tell you a story I heard in the Shema, the day of Rishol Zalman. And somebody came to ask Rishol Zalman a question, a very important question. And Rishol Zalman, as I understood the story, walked around the room. The person was so impressed with himself, so happy. He asked Rishol Zalman a question, just couldn't spit out the answer right away. Rishol Zalman walked to the window, called the person over from the window to come over here. And he says, he points outside, he says, that's where your Rav lives. Go ask your Rav to shine. A person needs to have a Rav. The person person who is your Rav does not have to be the Gadol HaDor. Moshe Feinstein may have been the Posek HaDor, the Gadol HaDor, but he wasn't every single Jewish person's individual rabbi. A shaila needs to be asked to a person who knows you well. Because the same exact shaila posed to a Rav that doesn't know you will get you possibly a different answer than the same exact shaila posed to the Rav who knows you well. And you have this all the time in halacha. You have to take into account, for example, Hesed Meruba, that can, in a simple, straightforward, Basu B'chalam Shaila, or a Kashra Shaila, Shulchanat, Shnei B'Ferish, it says over there, what the Shaila is. But the answer is, well, it's not true if you happen to be a very poor person. And when you go to present the Shaila to the Posek, if he doesn't know you, he may actually give the wrong answer. Now, that doesn't mean that every local Rav is competent to answer every single Shaila. But you're going to go with the derech of that Rav. You're going to go with his rabbanim, with his poskim. And if the person has a derech in life, he goes in his shilas to his local Orthodox Rav. That, I think, is the way my rabbi taught me that it should be done. The person has to establish for himself his posek. That posek doesn't have to have the ability, the godless, the knowledge to pass in every single shilas under the sun. But his Rav has a Rav. And that Rav may have a Rav. And you have a derech, a hashkafa, that is going to be, I think, the right way that a person should approach such problems. Otherwise, I choose for this posek that I found in HebrewBook.org. And this one, well, I found this guy that says this over there. And this, that's not a derech that a person should follow. We're told, asei l'cho rav. I think, maniyaz dati, that usually should be your local rav in your local shul. And he should be your guide. He should be the one you approach with all the shilas that you have in life. And when the shilas are above his pay grade, he'll tell you. He's an honest Rav. He'll tell you, this one is above me. Let me ask my Rebbe. God knows I do that all the time. I'm at the lower end of the pay scale. They're all the time going above my head. And I go and ask somebody that I trust and respect, my Rebbe. And every now and then it's over their head. And they'll go to the Gadol HaDor and ask a shaila that needs to be a Gadol HaDor shaila. Not every shaila is a Gadol HaDor shaila. The second point that you asked, what should you do in America? That's my biggest concern. In Eretz Yisrael, a beautiful system is set up to verify that brain death has, in fact, occurred. Whatever definition you wish to halachically accept, you need to verify it. My personal experience is that on the vast, vast majority of cases that I've seen in secular-run hospitals that don't have gedolim or poskim standing over the shoulders of people, the definition of brainstem death can easily be halachically not followed, even though the doctors will say this patient is brain dead. That's my personal opinion.
If I just may add to the last issue and the second question that you asked, I have heard people who do it, and I think the best advice is that whoever accepts in principle brain death because that is his opinion or his wife's opinion or whatever way he reached that he wants to be an organ donor to save life because he accepts brain death from a halakhic point of view, and he signs a donor card, he should add a qualification that it can be done only if it will be done with a competent rabbi, whether it's appointed by name or whether the family knows who we want, that will make sure that indeed everything was done correctly. Now, in most countries, not in all, but in most countries, they accept the clinical criteria only, and they don't do any verifying or confirmatory tests. But I know that people are deaf people, I mean physicians, are desperate to get organs. And if you tell them that I'm willing to donate, but you have to confirm it with a transcranial Doppler, or with a nuclear scan, or with a brainstem auditory work response, or whatever test is available in this hospital, they'll be more than glad to do it, to make sure that you trust them and that it goes according to your wishes, and then you can be a legitimate, glad, kosher donor from this point of view.
Just to reinforce, following Dr. Steinberg's point, there are There's an advance directive document that's both written by the Rabbinical Council of America, as well as by the Gedolei Yisrael of America, which are available. There's a previous version of the Rabbinical Council of America. There's also a recent updated one. There's the Aguda. And those documents would certainly, I think, help, as exactly as Dr. Steinberg mentioned, because it provides a specific authorization as an advance directive in general to identify a rav or an alternative rav in terms of being able to make decisions for a person appropriately.
I'm going to actually change the format slightly in terms of how we're going to do it. I'm going to ask these people to raise their question, identify the speaker that you want to address your question, and then we're going to take a bunch of questions, and then we're going to have the panel answer it as a group. At this rate, we're obviously going to get through only a few questions. So, gentlemen, question, and then it's just please write down, and then we'll try to take a couple.
I have two questions to two panelists, if I may. So do I do it out loud or do I throw it
out?
Okay. So first of all, Rabbi Dr. Weiss, you have made use of the opinion of Rabbi Shaul Israeli, who said that since a person is dead is exempt from all duties, therefore, even in life is exempt from the consequences or having to fulfill what will happen after his death. And it would appear, at least perhaps, to be a dangerously slippery slope. For instance, it happens that after one's death, he's equally exempt from mitzvot lo ta'aseh as well as mitzvot aseh. So you could argue that, for instance, God says someone who is dying but is still capable to do anything may poison another person and be still potter of retzecha as long as he will die before the person is poisoned, for instance, or many other such. So would that indeed be the implication? And another question for Rabbi Glatz. First of all, a big yishar kol, you definitely gave us a whole new spin on segregation of Elohimot. But when you very understandably offered some critique of the trend of publicly castigating the other side, would it be inconceivable that perhaps if either side, while doing so, believes that it might further their cause, and as they see their cause being the issue of tikkun nefesh, of actually saving human lives, couldn't that, from their perspective, outweigh even the possibility of Hilul Hashem, actually, the certainty of Hilul Hashem?
Thank you. Can we have the next question?
Rabbi Weiss, the source you quoted from the Chavadah seems to make an organ donor mutter only for a Jew. Can you comment on that, please?
Thank you.
Dr. Glatz, you said it's difficult to, you can't test a ghostus because, you can't interfere with a ghostus because that's forbidden, but you also can't do anything to disturb a mace. So how can you do something test because you don't know which either one at the moment, you don't know what they do.
Rabbi Dr. Glatz, a comment. Just a comment and a question. The thing you said about in America, the brain death criteria are not very strictly applied. I would just like to say that I believe that in Canada they are very strictly applied. Okay, and it'd be interesting to have comments on that. And the question, the thing you said about there's a controversy about whether the hypothalamus is survives after brain death. I believe, I would like to comment, I can't believe this is controversial. I think it's clear that in many, many brain death patients that the hypothalamus survives for a few days and these patients maintain their temperature and other functions for a few days, and it's clear that it survives. I'd like to comment.
Dr. Steinberg, I'm glad to mention that over the last 12 months, it seems to be a particular controversy. Sort of wondering what happened before that. My impression was that there was there may more ban in favor of sort of the cardiovascular death, the brain death conferences that you'd be going steam. Could you predict in a way what will be the trend over time? Is it likely to continue moving?
I think we'll allow our panelists to tackle these first. If there's more time, we'll take some more questions. We'll start from right to left, from my wife.
Regarding the very interesting question that you raised about a ghost ace, again using Dr. Glatt's definition, which by definition he said is approximate, somebody who's imminently dying. The implication of your question is that a ghost ace can be conscious, which I think is a valid assumption as well. Others might say that a ghost ace by definition requires the person is already unconscious, but be it as it may, when I was growing up, I don't know if this has anything to do with anything, but it doesn't matter. When I was growing up, I used to watch the television show Columbo. So Peter Falk just passed away. Yes, a very interesting fellow, by the way. He had, I used to know him, he had one eye, because he lost eye. He served, I think he wanted to, or he did actually want to serve in Israel at one point, in the army. So this is like a Columbo episode where somebody poisons somebody and then dies, and then how do you decide who actually was the victim? It sounds like a Columbo type of thing. But I digress. The responsibility of harming another individual or killing another individual is not necessarily bound by temporal parameters, which means that if a person performs an act today that results in a person's having a shortened lifespan by 5 minutes 50 years from now, the activity, the action that the person did today holds them culpable. If they die before the other person, so obviously Bezdin cannot implement, but that doesn't mean that their action, if you will, when they performed it, was an act of Ritzicha at that time. I don't even know if it's necessarily retroactive or literally at that time. It becomes like a Gilu Milsalam Afrei. It becomes retroactively evident that what they did was considered to be damaging at that time. That's the basis for many poskim who assume that smoking, for example, is a prohibited activity of Nishmartem Odenafsho Seichem. Even though the person is not going to die tomorrow, the cumulative effects of smoking over time at that time. But the fact is that each, if you will, smoking experience or each inhalation contributes so that it's not necessarily bound by time. So even if the ghost, if you will, dies before the other person, they're held culpable not at that time, but for what they did when they were living. That's where it's an interesting, though, parallel that thought of as you were talking as well, is that there are discussions in the poskim. Unfortunately, it happens sometimes. Rabbi Leo Bakshi Doron has in his Chuvas a situation where there was a young couple, and the young man was diagnosed with cancer, of which he died shortly, about two or so years after he was married. And the question about freezing or cryopreserving his sperm. So that particular detail of the shala is important, but the concept of, again, a posthumous, you will eat in vitro fertilization. And how would you view that? That's perhaps related to that, but I think the obligation is meyaksha. Second question that was raised about your reading of Kaved Das of Nefesh Yisrael. So I don't know specifically necessarily what how Rav Yosef would answer your question, but I would answer the following, so I don't want to make believe that I'm representing him. Rav Yosef can speak quite intelligently on his own. So I actually had the privilege of meeting him once. I actually brought him a tea. He was visiting Yeshiva University many years ago. He came to give some shiurim. So sometimes he wore the whole Sephardic garb, which was very impressive. Sometimes he wore the regular black, which was not as impressive. But he gave a shiur once, and I think he wanted a tea, so I was asked to go across the street to wherever it was, across from the Beis Medrash and Reitz, and to bring him a tea. So I have a close connection to him. So, technically speaking, one could suggest that the obligations of saving another person's life are based on Pesukim in the Chumash, Lo Samad Al Dam Riecha, or Shev Tishi Ben Ulo, which are Pesukim that talk about our interrelationships between Jew and Jew. So that the obligations, if you will, as an obligation, as a mandate, technically, would be perhaps between Jew and Jew. There is a concept of Mfarnes in Aniyei Akum, in Aniyei Yisrael, for example, that an act of tzedakah and graciousness and kindness should be directed towards non-Jew and Jew alike. But I think to answer your question then, the obligation, it begins with my obligation towards a fellow Jew, and from that perhaps it extends either as obligatory or as an act of tremendous tzedakah and chesed to provide to another person, an EA Akum, an EA Yisrael, even if the primary obligation, or perhaps the more technical one, is between Jew and Jew.
A couple of questions that were asked to me, I'm trying to give responses to. An interesting question regarding whether you are allowed to make a Chilul Hashem or a public acrimony for Pikuach Nefashos. So I think that would be a question that we could talk about assuming it was necessary. I really, really don't think that type of a discussion actually improves the likelihood that one side will win out against the other. So I think it's if the question is a good question but doesn't get off the ground. If the question were to get off the ground, then I don't think that Chil Shamayim does trump. It's not technically considered one of the cardinal three sins, but Chil Hashem is the only sin for which even Misa is not Mechaper. So we're dealing here with a very, very high level, and I would tend to doubt that it would even be helpful to add to one side, let's pile on Chil Hashem to our side, because that will make our opinion that much more likely to be accepted. So I would disagree with the premise. Assuming the premise was even correct, I don't think halachically it would be allowed. I think that the proper way that we're taught by Chazal to argue is to argue points. One can say, I respectfully disagree with your argument. I respectfully disagree with the conclusion that you have made. I respectfully disagree with your logic. That should not then be, well, therefore you're an idiot. And that's where the problem, I think, the recent controversy that was alluded to, for whatever the reason, and I think I'll actually be speaking on Sunday a lot more about it, where the controversy, I think, has come out of, and it's in the packets that Rabbi Weiss put it in, I think it's on page 92, was this statement that was published by a number of very distinguished individuals that I would like to talk about a lot more on Sunday, because it revolves around something that we see in a lot of facets of life, and that is, well, if you say it's us, so how come you're doing it? Are you here? Well, you say it's us and go and transplant this organ, how can you accept the organ? And you have the same thing, well, you don't believe in Medinas Yisrael, you don't fight in the army, but how come you like living in Eretz Yisrael and all the benefits that the army is giving you? Well, you don't like to work, you want to sit in base medical day, well, how come you accept my stock? My stock is good for you, my money's good for you, but I'm not good for you. And that is an emotional, non-halachic argument that I think we have to separate from any halachic arguments that you have, whether you're for the Medina, against the Medina, you're for Tzal, you're against Tzal, whether you're for Kolel, against Kolel, you're for this or that. They're halachic, legitimate viewpoints. To then turn them into personal attacks, say, well, if you don't accept this, then you also, and it's ethically reprehensible to take a dual organ when you don't believe it, that's a different discussion, and I think that's why it's been heated up, and I'll actually be addressing that. My discussion on Sunday will address this. I won't address that more now. The other question that was specifically asked for me, and this one I left as a question intentionally because I'm not sure what the answer is. That is, how are you allowed to test the goseis, to do these confirmatory tests on the goseis? And the Mishmas Avraham, Rabbi Dr. Avraham raises that question in his Sefer Mishmas Avraham. I think there are answers to it. I think that there are people that aren't happy with some of the answers that are given to that question. If you're not allowed to move a goseis, if you're not allowed to do a test on a goseis, so then one could argue that it's problematic to do the confirmatory test, which if you insist that the confirmatory test be done, leaves you in the catch-22. Right. There are arguments to negate that. I pointed out that it's a question. And that's really the same additional question was asked me, what about the hypothalamus? I wasn't questioning on the scientific facts, although there are some of the points that are debatable scientifically. The question is, the fact that the hypothalamus is still functioning on at least a microscopic level or even on a macroscopic level, does that qualify for physiological decapitation? That's something that one could argue about. Yes, I think that means that it's not physiological decapitation in its entirety. enough so that I would therefore say the patient is still alive, not in very good condition. Or one can say, no, that just like I can show you the circulation to the leg, I cut the leg, it will bleed in the brain dead person. So the fact that I have blood going to the hypothalamus is unimportant because that doesn't fulfill the essential part of the brain. So those were the major questions I was asking. You mentioned one other thing about Canada. I think we're talking about two different things. I'm not talking about the fact that Canadian physicians are maybe more ethical than an American physician. That's not Chas V'Shalom what I was suggesting. What I'm suggesting is the fact that the confirmatory tests are not done in most situations is what I was referring to. It is extremely unusual, in my opinion, for people to do confirmatory tests in the United States on brain dead people to confirm that they're halachically brain dead as opposed to New York State law brain dead. And that's what I was referring to. And unless people who are of the opinion that brain stem death is an adequate halachic definition, they then need to make sure that they in fact are halachically brain stem dead, and then that's fine. Follow that opinion. And then maybe you'll tell me it's different in Canada, but my guess is that all of the definitive criteria that Rabbi Steinberg so nicely outlined that are being done in Eretz Yisrael now, I don't think that they're being done in New York, and I would be interested to see if you're telling me that they're done in Canada.
No, the confirmatory tests are not usually done in Canada, no.
And that's really the question. Are you willing to allow a person who has strong feelings? I know a lot of physicians. This week, again, Meiser Shahoya, we had a PA that didn't want to code a patient when the patient was not a DNR. The patient and the family wanted a code. The patient didn't survive the code that was ultimately done. One could argue, was this code necessary? Was this resuscitative attempt the right thing to do? The bottom line is that patient's family wanted it done. And this physician's assistant, it could have been a physician, no difference, took it upon themselves to say, I'm going to poskin for this family because I don't want to butcher. They did that from a good place in their heart, but just a very stupid place in their brain. I think those are the questions I was going to say.
I was asked a prophecy question, and I'm not a prophet, and you know, prophecy today, who gets it? So I don't want to be this category. But seriously, I think that this dispute, the halachic dispute, is to stay. I mean, those who understand the sources that relate to the heart as the heart we understand today and feel that as long as the heart is functioning, the person is alive, I don't see a reason why they will change their minds from a pure halachic point of view. And the same holds true for those who hold that respiration is the criterion. I don't see what argument can be invented more than we know today that they'll change their minds. I think in practice, things might change. And the practice will be that more and more, and as Dr. Rabbi Weiss pointed out, more and more people need organs. And more people will die because of lack of organs. And I don't know what Rabbi Glatt will speak on Sunday about, are you allowed to receive if you don't want to give. But with time, that will create an enormous pressure. How come that you are not donating and I am going to die because you don't want to donate to me, but if I die, you want my heart and you want to save your life? Whether halakhically it's acceptable or not is disputable, but morally it is a major problem. So I think that from a societal point of view, there will be a great pressure. How the poskim will deal with it, I can't predict. But from purely halachic point of view, I think it is to stay. But I think there will be other options. And probably, I assume, in 10 years or maybe even less, we won't have to waste our time here on this issue. A, I think that stem cell research might be advanced to a degree that it will create organs. And once we have free organs by stem cells, then we don't need donations neither from the life nor from the dead, nor from this type of dead. And I think that is going in the right direction, and probably that will solve this issue. So we are in a transitional stage where people are dying now. They can't wait for the stem cell research to
to produce cells, and we need to answer them today. But in the future, if you ask, I have a good feeling that it will be not necessary and the dispute will become an academic dispute. Also, there is now a move to obtain organs from a cardiac dead person. And there are ways how to do it. Some of them are certainly contrary to halacha, and they will not be accepted by anyone in halacha, neither from this side of the fence or there. But some can be accepted halakhically, and perhaps some organs will be able to be obtained after cardiac death, which everyone agrees that that is dead. So I think that there will be changes, but on the fundamental debate, I don't see a reason why one will give up his opinion to the other. And if I may just elaborate a little bit about the goiters and the hypothalamus. I think there is a confusion in discussing this issue. This issue is relevant only to Avshalom Zalman Auerbach's position. According to Avshalom Zalman Auerbach, his definition, and I wrote it in his name, and he corrected twice the draft that I wrote, and I think it is authentic. He defined a clinically diagnosed brain dead person as Sofek Meis, Sofek Goises. That is his definition. Now, once you introduce the Sofek Goises, you run into the catch 22. How do you get him out of the Sofek? The only way to get him out of the Sofek is to prove that his brain is dead. But in order to prove that his brain is dead, you need to do confirmatory tests, which means to move the patient, and if you have to move the patient, you're not allowed to do it because it is esophagosis. But all the other poskim on both sides of the fence, whether you accept cardiac death or respiratory death, don't define this situation as a goisis. According to Avi Yashiv, this person is alive. He's a regular dying patient that we don't know how to define gesisa. No one knows today how to define gesisa. So according to him, he's a live person, and you can move him, you can do tests if it would be helpful. According to those who accept respiratory tests, then once you confirm clinically that he is not breathing, he is dead. The confirmatory tests are only to assure that it's irreversible, and that is not a goises situation. And therefore, on either side of the fence, it is not a goises. So either he is alive or he is dead. The goises comes in only if you take the brain as such, and you have to prove that the whole brain is dead, then before you prove it, it is a sophagoises. And that is only from Zalman's position. Now, the hypothalamus issue is again the same thing. If you take respiration as the sign of life and death, then who cares that the hypothalamus is alive? It has nothing to do with respiration. And therefore, Rabbi Blatt said, if the leg has circulation and the hypothalamus has circulation, both are irrelevant to respiration. And if you take the heart as a sign, then even if the hypothalamus would have been dead, it wouldn't be enough. So the hypothalamus doesn't play any role in the controversy between the two major positions. According to Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, that he requires that the whole brain be dead, the question is hypothalamus brain? And some argue, and I think they are right from a physiological and a neurological point of view, that the hypothalamus is not brain. The function of a hypothalamus is an endocrine function. It is not a function of a brain. It is situated in the skull, but the fact that it's there doesn't mean that it's brain. And therefore, even though there is some blood flow to the hypothalamus and it's still functioning, it can be brain dead, even according to Shlomo Zalman, or since it is connected to the brain, you need that to be dead as well if you want to define whole brain death according to Shlomo Zalman. But these two issues are relevant only if you take the brain as a criterion of death. But no one except for Shlomo Zalman, to my understanding, feels that way, but it's either respiration or cardiac, and then he's either alive or dead, and he's not a goises, and the hypothalamus is irrelevant one way or the other.
Just to add one more layer, I believe Rav Moshe Feinstein in the Chelik Beis of Choshen Mishpat, he has a whole series of questions about end-of-life issues, and I believe I heard a similar idea from Rav Schechter as well, is that that, if you will, special halacha at the end of your day that says one is not permitted to be mazed, is not permitted to manipulate a ghost ace, somebody who's imminently dying, because of a concern like causing an acceleration of the person's death. So I believe Rav Moshe suggests, and I think I heard that, I did hear this from Rav Schechter, a similar suggestion, that that isser is a special isser that applies to Jews, meaning that as a Jew, my restriction on in any way causing an accelerated death even includes that kind of manipulation of the ghosts. But that isser may not apply to non-Jews, meaning a non-Jew who is certainly prohibited from committing murder or from killing may not be restricted to that extent that they not permitted to manipulate the ghost ace because of this concern. So with that possibility, suggestion in mind, if the confirmatory tests, that doesn't necessarily help in Eretz Yisrael, it may help in Chutzlars, where we're not doing confirmatory tests, in terms of having non-Jewish staff. It's not a mural in offering, it's not that kind of idea. It's made that restriction of not manipulating ghosts may only be, if you will, a Jewish law, not necessarily a universal law.
I'd like to take this opportunity to thank the panel for a wonderful discussion this morning.